here. Perimeter really is a very special place, and I was very sad to leave. But I'm glad to say I've now got a visiting position here, so I'm going to be coming back regularly, which I'm very much looking forward to. So the work I'm going to describe is with Lathan Boyle, who I've succeeded in stealing from Perimeter. So he's going to be at Edinburgh, but he too, I'm sure, will be back regularly to enjoy this very special environment here. I'm going to tell you about this. So I know people like these titles of ADS, CFT, and so on and so forth. So in a joke on that, I'm calling this the standard model LCDM cosmology. And the emphasis here is on minimal. We want to try to explain as much as possible, assuming as little as possible. And that's the objective of theoretical physics, and that's the spirit behind this talk. So I'll talk a little bit about the consensus, current consensus in cosmology, which I'm going to be presenting an alternative to. So the current consensus was that the Big Bang singularity is indescribable. If you ask a string theorist what happened at the singularity, they typically say, much too hard a problem. Okay. So then one assumes that somehow, just after the singularity, there was an epoch of inflation. It's more or less like introducing some explosive to make a Big Bang. And that's that picture has dominated cosmology for the last 40 plus years. The problem with it is rather arbitrary. You can introduce many different kinds of explosive, and the phenomena we're trying to explain are rather simple. And so you've typically got much more freedom to make theories than we have observations to test them with. After inflation, we enter a standard period of Big Bang expansion, and the microwave background radiation was released about 380,000 years after the Big Bang, and that's what we see around us today. Inflation was a fantastic idea. It was absolutely groundbreaking, especially connecting quantum fluctuations to what we see on very large scales in the universe. But I would argue it's a theory whose star is beginning to fade. So far, all we see is vanilla lambda CDM, and I'll describe exactly what that is, compared to a vast landscape of inflation models. There's thousands, many thousands of inflation models with many thousands of parameters and arbitrary assumptions about initial conditions and so on and so forth. And so there's a sort of huge theoretical redundancy within this conventional paradigm. No sign of a multiverse, a strangely appealing idea. I never really understood what people saw in it, but some people seem to believe in it. There's absolutely no evidence for it. People like Matt Johnson have really looked for it, tried to propose tests of the idea, which is very important. And so far, no sign of that. Most impressive, the upper bound on tensor modes, and this really was thought to be the smoking gun signal of inflation, understood in the early 1980s, that this explosion you introduce will amplify gravitational wave modes in the vacuum, and they will appear on very large scales. So Stephen Hawking, for example, had a famous bet with me where he bet that the Planck satellite would observe these tensor modes. They're not there so far. So for example, the simplest inflation model, phi squared inflation, which people typically teach in graduate courses, that's now ruled out. And the experimenters project that the bound on tensor mode is going to fall by a factor of 10 in the next 4 years. So I think for all these reasons, it's a very good time, and it's very important to develop alternatives. Here's the data from a preprint last year, which has been attracted surprisingly little attention, but this is from the top experimental group, setting limits on the tensor component, or long wavelength gravitational wave component of the CMB anisotropy. And so the upper limit is down here now at about 3%. Phi squared inflation is at about 15%, so that's quite clearly ruled out. And these were some sort of string-inspired models, which are not looking too good either. So what I'm going to explain in this talk is a new way to explain the perturbations in cosmology. And it happens to get this number spot on and doesn't require inflation. So to remind you what vanilla lambda CTM is, it's a remarkable fact that to describe the universe on large scales, we seem to only need five fundamental physics parameters. Three describe the matter or energy content, and two describe the fluctuations. So it's really an astonishingly simple universe that we live in on large scales, and as the precision of observations has improved, nothing much has changed. These five numbers are sufficient to account for everything that we see. So the first of these, as in the name indicates, is the cosmological constant, or lambda, sometimes called the dark energy. But really, this dates back to 1920, the 1910s and 1920, when Einstein wrote down the first cosmological model. Second parameter is the dark matter to baryon density. So this number is about a factor of five, about five times more dark matter than baryons. I'll explain the dark matter in this talk, but that won't be the main emphasis. If you ask questions, I'll give more details. Turns out the explanation is relatively simple for what it is. The baryons per photon, another fundamental parameter, so-called baryon asymmetry. So these three numbers, it's about one part in a billion. So these numbers parameterize the energy content in the universe. The fluctuations we usually describe, for example, by talking about the Newtonian gravitational potential, or the metric perturbation in GR. It's a dimensionless quantity, and the power spectrum of it is given by some amplitude times a small, what we call tilt. So there's a k-dependent power spectrum indicating a slightly more power on large scales than small. And there's an exponent here, which is traditionally called ns minus 1. And I'm going to explain that this exponent here is a critical exponent or anomalous dimension in our theory, which is calculable in perturbation theory. And the theory I'll tell you about gets that number right and relates it to the coupling constant of QCD at the Planck scale. So we also predict this number and also get that number right. So taking this power spectrum from the observations, the RMS gravitational potential on large scales, on a scale k of about k star, is the square root of this amplitude. It's about 3 times 10 to the minus 5. So that's a number we hope to explain from fundamental physics, and I'll give you an explanation later in the talk. Of course, if you take the gravitational potential, that determines the redshifting or blue-shifting of photons as they're emitted from the surface of last scattering and travel to us. And the gravitational potential is about 3 times 10 to the minus 5, a very famous calculation by Sachs and Wolff in the 1960s related that to the gravitational potential, just a factor of a third. So delta T over T on the sky is about 10 to the minus 5. Temperature is 3 Kelvin. Delta T over T is about 30 microkelvin. And that's what we see. This small red tilt is, this algebra is wrong. The ns minus 1, ns is 0.96, and so ns minus 1 is 0.04. Cosmologists can't do algebra. So that should be 0.04 here, and what it's telling you actually should be minus 0.04. What it's telling you is that k gets smaller, the fluctuations get stronger. Very many quantities consistent with zero. For example, there's no curvature of space on large scales. Space seems to be flat, Euclidean, and there are no tensor modes. I've told you all that. The composition of the universe doesn't seem to vary from place to place. And as we look, to the CMB, we look to this red surface here. The blue circle is the Big Bang singularity. The red surface is the CMB. As we look out to the CMB, this is what we see. These fluctuations, they seem to be Gaussian noise with a nearly scale-invariant power spectrum. And at least the primordial spectrum is this one. It that then gets processed by acoustic oscillations in the plasma. And so when you calculate the power spectrum, when you measure the power spectrum, it's this famous red curve, which Jim Peebles won his Nobel Prize for predicting in the early 1970s. And we were lucky enough to get in on this in the 90s, and we calculated, as Will mentioned, the polarization temperature cross correlation. This is a rather beautiful prediction because there are no free parameters in this curve. So if you fit the cosmology to the lower curve, you predict the upper curve, and you see the data just fits beautifully on it. So these and other things should convince you the cosmos is really very, very simple and predictable. There's no randomness on large scales. The laws of physics are the ones we know, and the whole universe obeys them. So in this talk, I'm going to talk about a new framework for connecting the standard model to Lambda CDM and explaining those five, connecting those five parameters to the standard model. We'll explain two of the numbers, and the others will fit in various ways. The surprising thing about this is that we don't need any new particles beyond those already in the standard model. And I'm going to define the standard model to include right-handed neutrinos, because we need those to explain the neutrino oscillations and the small neutrino masses. So standard model including right-handed neutrinos, I would claim, is sufficient to explain everything in Lambda CDM. There's no need for inflation. So this is the picture, and I will detail this as we go along. We sit here, 14 billion years after the Big Bang. As we look back in time, this is our past light cone. The past light cone in physical extent, in proper length units, is 10 microns across at the Planck temperature and Planck density. And so that's the patch of the Big Bang that we can see. Okay, if we take that same patch and we expand it going forwards, it now stretches out 20 gigaparsecs in radius around us. And then this purple surface here shows the outer extent of the co-moving Planck length. Okay, so if I take a Planck length at the Big Bang and expand it, co-moving to today, it's about a millimeter across. And that, of course, is roughly the wavelength of the microwave background radiation. So it literally just sort of came out of the Big Bang and stretched all the way to us. The ratio of these two lengths is about 10 to the 30. And my central claim is that the Big Bang at the Big Bang, the universe was a statistical mechanical system with a critical exponent, and we'll calculate the critical exponent and show that the power spectrum has a tilt, and this tilt can be extrapolated 30 orders of magnitude in length scale. Okay, so I should warn you, there's this huge extrapolation we're going to do. It's the same extrapolation as saying that, you know, nothing new was found at the LHC. And so let's just extrapolate from the LHC to the Planck scale and assume there's nothing to be found. Okay, so some people are very disappointed at that. But I think, you know, if nature turns out to be simple, that's a good thing. So this is the underlying picture behind what we're doing. So here's our, if you like, part of the universe. There was the Big Bang singularity, out of which the patch of space we're in emerged. What we noticed a few years ago is that if you impose CPT symmetry, many of the properties of the universe follow. Okay, so CPT symmetry is the most fundamental symmetry known of all quantum field theories. It's basically related to Lorentz invariance and analyticity of scattering amplitudes. And our fundamental hypothesis is that the universe itself does not violate this symmetry. Okay, that's it. So how does this affect the singularity? Well, let us assume that at the singularity, the universe was full of radiation, for which there's lots of evidence. We see the CMB today. And let's furthermore assume that that radiation was perfectly conformal symmetric. The trace of the stress tensor was zero. Conformal symmetry means you can change the local scale of space-time, and the matter is not sensitive to that. So just a traceless stress tensor, P is 1/3 rho for the fluid in the universe. And what we realized is that conformal symmetry of the matter implies that there is an analytic solution of GR, in fact, a set of space-times that solve GR with the fluid, which are analytic at the Big Bang, and therefore can be analytically extended through the singularity to the other side. And so, in fact, here are these solutions. And this you can check easily. These solutions were actually known since the 1970s, but not interpreted this way. There is a general class of solutions to the Einstein radiation fluid equations that take this form. T is the scale factor, so that would be the cosmological scale factor. And that was the first clue in our picture, that the cosmic scale factor is linear in the conformal time as you go towards t equals zero. A function which is linear, has a simple zero, is obviously easy to extrapolate through t equals zero. It's completely analytic. The interesting thing is that there's a generic class of such solutions, which look like this, where you can go to synchronous gauge, and then they look like analytic functions of t, which take this form near t equals zero. So they have a regular Taylor series expansion, and this hij zero is arbitrary. So there's an arbitrary conformal three-metric, and then there are solutions of the Einstein equations for any such three-metric, which are symmetrical under t goes to minus t. The singularity is purely conformal. It's a very simple type of singularity. It's just where the overall scale goes to zero. Okay. So the conformal four geometry, which is this, is completely regular. And this relates to a very old hypothesis of Roger Penrose from the 1970s, where he conjectured that the Big Bang singularity had zero Weyl curvature. That conjecture was then sort of improved, where people said, no, the Weyl curvature is finite. And essentially, that just means that this conformal four geometry is regular. And we now have a derivation of that hypothesis from the gravitational path integral. So imagine I do the gravitational path integral with an initial and a final three geometry, and I find, so I'm supposed to sum over all four geometries which connect those two. And the statement is that there are saddles of the gravitational path integral, which are classical solutions of the equations of motion, which have only a conformal singularity. And so this is the case if you impose that the initial scale factor is the negative of the final scale factor. That's what time reversal symmetry does. It reverses the scale factor. And if you say that the scale factor is plus, the initial scale factor is plus the final one, then, in fact, this geometry equals that geometry, and the saddle is actually trivial. The four geometry is trivial, This was first understood by John Wheeler a long time ago. He said, if you formulate gravity in this way by specifying initial and final three geometry, he said a condition for this to be a sensible path integral for gravity is that if you make the two geometries identical, there should be no four geometry in between them. That should be the simultaneous. So time is emergent in this picture. So the new twist that we added was to reverse the scale factor. This leaves the three geometry invariant, but it gives you this saddle point with the Big Bang singularity. So this is, we claim this is the picture of what the Big Bang is. Penrose's hypothesis follows from this. In other words, if I specify these two geometries are identical, they're related by, so you could just think about this as an hourglass. You turn upside down, the top and the bottom are identical. You now look for saddles. The saddles are only, the only singularity is conformal. And that means that the Weyl curvature is finite at the Big Bang singularity. So this is, implies Penrose's Weyl curvature hypothesis. Sure.
So if I remember correctly, to tie this hypothesis.
Yes.
Because, you know, you yes. About a second.
Yes, so it is tied because time goes away from the singularity. No, it's tied in this example just as well. You notice, you know, this is where the matter is hot and dense, and so the arrow of time for somebody on this side is exactly the opposite of the arrow of time for somebody on this side. So it's the same thing. In fact, a good way to think about this is that imposing CPT symmetry on the initial and final three geometry is really just using the method of images to impose CPT symmetric boundary conditions at the bang itself. Okay, so you should think about the Big Bang as a mirror, and with a mirror you've got a choice. Either you solve Maxwell's equations with the correct boundary conditions at the mirror, or you just make a mirror image of yourself behind the mirror, throw the mirror away, and solve the free space Maxwell equations. So this you should think about the other half of the universe as a mathematical convenience. It's not identical to this half. What is identical is the initial and the final three geometry, or however you specify them. You should sum over the intermediate four geometries. So, for example, in this picture, the Big Bang point can fluctuate quantum mechanically. It could, in some contributing paths, it will be more on one side than the other. And one can calculate those fluctuations. Okay, so whereas the conventional picture is sort of somebody goes and lights a match, or inserts explosive here, and that's the worst possible place to do it because that's the place where space-time doesn't really make sense, and so you absolutely don't know what you're doing. So what we're doing is instead specifying, if you like, initial and final states where the geometry is large, and then we're essentially using analyticity to deal with what happens at the interesting point in the middle. Okay, so the way we do this, we'll start from homogeneous isotropic backgrounds and then extend to generic metrics using cosmological perturbation theory. So that's just the normal approach to cosmology, which is extremely successful in explaining the observations. So the topic I'm going to talk about mostly is this one. Penrose, again, drew this beautiful picture. Whatever the creator did, it's only a metaphor, I don't think Penrose is religious, whatever the creator did, somehow the universe emerged with an extremely special large-scale geometry. It's almost homogeneous, almost isotropic, and spatially flat, not spatially curved, and he posed this as a very big puzzle. We're going to address this by thinking about path integrals and gravity, as I've already described. And so here's the standard model and gravity, including gravity, and all the amplitudes or physical processes we know of seem to be described by this path integral. And then we're going to use a trick which Stephen Hawking pioneered, which is to use the same path integral but use periodic boundary conditions in imaginary time and claim that that gives us the partition function. Okay, so we're going to use this, instead of getting amplitudes, we're going to calculate the partition function, and the partition function we'll use to get the number of states. So the idea is you just compute your path integral, impose periodicity in imaginary time, and then this, the saddle point of this exponent gives you the gravitational entropy. Okay, so that was the idea very successfully pursued for black holes. So, as you know, black hole thermodynamics is now a big, very big field. It's not converged. People don't really understand what black hole entropy is, but there's a lot of evidence from many different directions that this is the right way to think about black holes. And so in this case, the entropy is telling you, the exponential of the entropy is telling you how many different ways there are to make a black hole. Before our work, people had done the same for De Sitter, which is the simplest cosmology, the one Einstein first invented in I think, 1917. So just take Einstein theory with a cosmological constant, and the solution is De Sitter spacetime. The gravitational entropy in this case, we just need to compute the Euclidean, we compute this exponent. We do it by going to Euclidean time and just calculating the exponent. The trace of the Einstein equations gives you the Ricci scalar in terms of the density of the lambda, and this is what you get using the volume of a four sphere. And so this number is about 10 to the 122 for today's lambda. It's called the De Sitter entropy. It's a very big number, because if you take the total entropy, just the normal entropy of radiation in our Hubble volume, it's about 10 to the 90. So the gravitational entropy is very significant. And our basic argument is we're going to calculate the gravitational entropy for a realistic universe, not this one, but one with radiation, matter, and actually arbitrary space curvature, and we're going to discover that that favors, that can exceed this number. That was the first surprise, as this was thought to be a bound before our work. It can exceed that number, and the most probable universe, the one with the greatest entropy, looks like ours. It's spatially flat and homogeneous and isotropic, and in fact, a small positive lambda is favored, like we see. So let's extend this to a realistic cosmology. And I think with hindsight, it's puzzling nobody did this before, because it's really, the key observation is very trivial, which is that if you take a cosmological metric, scale factor, we write it in conformal time, we assume space is homogeneous and isotropic, so there's a symmetric space with some three curvature, then the Friedmann equation looks like this. Okay, so radiation comes in here, R, mu, kappa, and lambda are just constants. I've ignored numerical factors. And here it is. So that's the Einstein equation for cosmologies with these ingredients. Now, one look at this equation, you see it's a particle in aquatic potential, and that was solved in the 19th century, and the solution of Jacobi elliptic functions. So that was, it should have been immediately obvious that in fact the solution is doubly periodic in complex time. So there is a period, just like a black hole metric is periodic in imaginary time, so it turns out the generic case of cosmology is periodic in imaginary time, and therefore it defines a Hawking temperature and a gravitational entropy. Now, just to elaborate that the conformal symmetry, so here we've assumed conformal symmetry because this radiation is perfect radiation, the traceless stress tensor, and if the stress tensor is traceless, then the Einstein equation implies the Ricci curvature is zero. And then you just calculate the Ricci curvature of this metric, and you'll find it involves A double dot. It's zero, so A is linear in T. And so that's this conformal symmetry is directly related to the fact that the solutions of this equation are analytic at T equals zero. You can see the general solution has simple poles, because the other solution of this equation is when A is very large, A goes like 1 over T. And so this goes as 1 over T to the fourth, and so does that. That's a simple pole. And that's De Sitter. That's the future De Sitter boundary of our universe. So we see simple poles and simple zeros characterize this solution. So if we look in real time, here's the Big Bang, simple zero. Here's future De Sitter infinity as a simple pole. The blue curve is the realistic universe. The red one, the dashed ones, are various other cases, recollapsing universes or De Sitter-like universes that bounce. But the key is that this function A of T is single-valued and doubly periodic in the complex T-plane, and its only singularities are simple poles. So here is the function A of T, the real and the imaginary part. This is the complex T-plane, and you see it has a fundamental domain, which is a rectangle in general. So that means that the function is really defined on a torus. And as soon as you see the torus, you see, well, I could calculate the action on a non-contractible loop around the torus. And that action is the entropy. That's the gravitational entropy. So the period around the torus in proper units defines the Hawking temperature of the realistic universe with stuff in it. And the action computed on that non-trivial cycle is the entropy. And by the way, it's a topological invariant, because you can distort this contour whichever way you like. As long as it circles the period once, you'll get the same answer by Cauchy's theorem. So here's the Euclidean instanton for a closed universe. Space goes around this way. I've drawn S1, but actually it's S3. And then imaginary time goes this way. So we recently calculated this gravitational entropy and found that it favors a homogeneous, isotropic, and spatially flat universe, like the one we see. And it also favors a small positive cosmological constant. And that argument's not so original. In fact, Hawking and earlier Baum had written papers saying the gravitational entropy goes like 1 over lambda, so the number of states favors lambda being small, and lambda being small and positive. And I can talk more about that if you like. So at this point, it's just a sort of nice correlation. Universes like ours seem very likely. Here are detailed calculations for kappa positive, kappa negative. I should say, for negatively curved universe, we take a compact subspace of a 3 hyperboloid. The particular topology is not very important. Qualitatively, the behavior is exactly the same. So here's a positive kappa on the left side. This is the curvature, or the curvature parameter, omega k. It tells you how important spatial curvature is in the history of the universe, and we just defined the maximum of omega k as a measure of that. The important point is that here we're varying essentially the radiation entropy on the horizontal axis, the total amount of mass in the universe on the vertical axis, and we're computing the maximum of this curvature parameter. And you should compare these pictures with the pictures for the entropy, gravitational entropy. So you see these two contours essentially correspond. So as you increase the entropy, the universe gets flatter and flatter. That was a surprise. And what it's telling you is you do not need any dynamics to flatten the universe. All you need is for the creator to be fair and to say, well, I'm going to put the universe where most universes are, And it's just the same explanation as why the gas in this room is homogeneous and isotropic and not all in one corner. And there are a lot more states for it to be homogeneous and isotropic than there are for the molecules to all be in one corner. You can understand this in terms of horizons. I won't go through this, but there's this very nice correspondence between the existence of horizons, which is only obvious in the Lorentzian theory, and very much related to the positive lambda, and the Euclidean calculation of the entropy. And so if we just try to understand the scaling of our answer, it turns out you can understand the scaling perfectly well by essentially saying that the universe came out of the Big Bang radiation-dominated, and including matter, and then at some point, lambda came to dominate. And you can ask, how big is the causal horizon of a point at lambda domination, and assign that to the de Sitter entropy. Just count the number of horizons and multiply that by the de Sitter entropy, and you get exactly our scaling. So it's definitely related to the existence of horizons. This was a nice picture from Quantum Magazine that described our work. And as it says, you just pick universes at random, and you will find the most probable one looks like ours.
Yeah. So you're basically saying you're doing the Boltzmann argument. What did the defense?
Yes, yes.
And
yes.
Now I can see that that entropy goes.
Well, just to know, I mean, the cheap way to get it is by thinking about horizons. So take a universe that comes out of the Big Bang and ask, when does it become lambda dominated? At that moment, calculate the volume of the, so you'd have a point in space-time, extrapolate that back to the Big Bang, ask how much of the Big Bang did it see, okay? And then basically assign that volume, the de Sitter entropy, but you've got more than one. You've got many such patches, and you just calculate the number of such patches. Essentially, when you make the universe flatter, you make the sphere bigger, okay? And that increases the entropy. So the scaling is quite easy to understand from this horizon argument. I just advise you to go through the algebra. It's not tricky. I mean, even from the Euclidean argument, you can just rescale things. I mean, I write down the Einstein action and rescale A and use the fact that you see, the beautiful thing with gravity is the period in imaginary time is determined dynamically. The metric itself is just a solution to this equation, and it determines this period. So there's no input temperature. The temperature is an output of the Einstein equation. And the scaling is really not hard to see. So I'm going to go on. So having explained the large-scale geometry of the universe, we've got a problem, which is the universe is not perfectly flat. It has small fluctuations, and they're very important. That's what we see in the sky. And that's what gave rise to galaxies and so on. So we started to think, where could these fluctuations have come from? And this led us to worry about quantum fields and gravity. When you couple quantum fields to gravity, you know, at step one, something pretty worrying happens, which is that the vacuum looks like this, okay? Quantum fields fluctuate on all scales down to arbitrarily short distances, and those fluctuations carry a lot of energy. And so the total energy in the quantum fluctuations is divergent. And that's very worrying because it couples to gravity. So in a nutshell, we found a new way to cancel that divergence. And that new way gives rise to the fluctuations we see in the cosmic microwave background. So now it's important to think about physical regularizations. Often people don't use physical regularizations. They use dimensional or some other trick just to throw away infinities. But one of the deepest thinkers about this field was Bryce DeWitt, and he wrote this beautiful article, many beautiful articles, but one in particular in the 70s. And he pointed out that a nice regulator, a nice physical regulator, is point splitting. So imagine I've got a free field theory, quadratic in the fields. A stress center is quadratic in the field, so split the 2 points. And if you make the separation time-like, that separation is essentially the inverse of an energy scale. So the bigger the separation, the lower the energy. And so as you put the 2 points together, you're summing over higher and higher energies. And so in particular, he focused on conformal field theories. These turn out to be much better behaved in these calculations, as he showed. And so the expectation value of T mu nu in the vacuum for Maxwell theory turns out to be this. You'll notice this is traceless using the eta, the Minkowski metric. This is traceless. But the divergence here is very bad. It's 1 over delta t to the fourth. So this calculation is completely Lorentz invariant. It's the delta t is the proper separation between the two time-like separated points. And that's the answer. Now, there's a problem, because actually it breaks Lorentz invariance. So calculation was Lorentz invariant. The answer is not. This is saying t mu nu isn't proportional to eta mu nu. So you've somehow, these fluctuations look like a radiation fluid, not like a lambda. You can renormalize this away, but that leaves you without any physical picture of the quantum field theory vacuum. Now, even worse than this divergence, this is a famous divergence, the vacuum energy, even worse are Weyl anomalies, where quantum divergences spoil the local symmetries of the Dirac and Maxwell theories. And in this case, you can't renormalize them away. These were discovered in the 70s. They're anomalies that cannot be renormalized away. So this is our new trick for removing these divergences. And it's surprisingly simple. You introduce a four-derivative, locally scale-invariant action. So here it is. It's not grad phi squared. It's box phi squared. And you see there are four derivatives here. There are four powers of length in the measure. And so phi is dimensionless. And that's why we call it a dimension zero scalar. Under scale transformation, it doesn't change. So here's this funny theory. It's all over the place in the literature. It's a very long history, which goes back to Heisenberg. Heisenberg was mainly interested in curing the infinities in quantum field theory. And so high derivatives do better by making the propagators more convergent. But then many other people got involved. Nakanishi relates this to gauge theory and quantization of gauge theories. A very interesting treatment of it is in Bogolyubov's last book on quantum field theory, where he calls this the dipole ghost. That was also introduced by Heisenberg. It's called dipole ghost because its propagator is 1 over k to the fourth. So it's like the square of the usual propagator. It's called a ghost because there are negative norm states in the Hilbert space when you quantize it. Now, Bogolyubov presents this as the simplest gauge theory. This is before U1. And he devotes 10 pages to it. He shows the Hilbert space is indefinite, but by projecting onto the positive semi-definite part of the Hilbert space, you define a sensible unitary theory, and in this it's just like a gauge theory. So it's a very interesting theory. It has an infinite dimensional symmetry, which is the analog of gauge symmetry, where phi of x goes to phi of x plus alpha, where alpha is harmonic. And you use this symmetry to eliminate all the negative norm states. This is reminiscent of the residual gauge symmetry in covariant gauges in QED, for example. So in this case, it turns out this symmetry is powerful enough when you project onto the positive part of the Hilbert space Symmetry is strong enough that the only surviving state is the vacuum. No excited states at all in this theory. There's just the vacuum. But in the vacuum, there's vacuum energy. Okay? And the vacuum energy turns out to be just right to cure all the problems in the standard model. So there are no excited states. And actually, the reason we got interested in this theory is the vacuum fluctuations in this theory are automatically scale invariant. So they're just like what we see in the sky. Okay, because this is dimensionless, when I write it as an integral over Fourier modes, it has to be d3k over k cubed, and that's what you need to explain the CMB. Okay, so vacuum energy and conformal anomalies. So vacuum energy, you've all studied in quantum field theory, you get half h bar k times plus 1 for every ordinary scalar, dimension one scalar, minus 2 for every Weyl fermion. There are two components, and you get a negative sign, plus 2 for the gauge fields, because there are two chiralities, and they're bosons. And then it turns out this dimension zero scalar gives plus 2. Okay? Not surprising, because they're double the number of derivatives. Calculate the trace anomaly. So you now put the quantum field theory in a curved background and ask, what does the trace look like? Just free field theory calculations. So part of the trace anomaly depends on this Euler density, and the other part depends on the Weyl density. And these numbers, the trace anomalies, are again just integers multiplied by certain funny factors. So sum of four positive integers. So take these three simultaneous equations in four positive integers and impose that the gauge group is SU3 cross SU2 cross U1, the standard model gauge group. So NA is 12, the dimension of this group. So we impose that, NA is 12, then there's a unique solution. Number of fermions has to be 4 times Na, it has to be 48. That's exactly right for the standard model with three generations, including one right-handed neutrino each generation. And the number of these new scalars is 36. So we have to have 36 of them. We're still trying to figure out where the 36 came from. And the number of ordinary scalars is 0. That's kind of sad because I hold the Higgs chair, but this calculation says there is no Higgs. Okay, now that's not too worrying. In fact, even Peter Higgs is not very worried about that, because the Higgs field, after all, is a low energy thing. And we know from superconductivity that there's no fundamental Higgs in superconductivity either. It's a condensate of fermions. And so what we should be thinking about is how to build a Higgs out of this dimension zero field. Yeah, as far as I know, nobody the question is that there are very strong constraints on how to create a Higgs field out of fermion bilinears. As far as I'm aware, nobody tried to do that using these dimension zero fields. So you see, it's very similar to string theory. In string theory, the world sheet coordinates of the string are dimensionless, and so you can exponentiate them. And a vertex operator is just e to the I k dot x, where x is dimensionless, and that has a non-trivial scaling dimension. So although... Yes, so the dimension zero scalar is exactly the analog in four dimensions. Because it's dimensionless, the two-point function is a log. This is a log. And by exponentiating it, you get operators with a non-zero scaling dimension. Okay, so that's one, that's an idea. It's actually in Bogoliubov's book. He just notices that you can get non-zero scaling dimension operators very easily. How you turn that into a Higgs with SU2 times U1 quantum numbers is another matter. Probably you will need the dimension zero scalars and the fermions. For example, you can write new right bar, new left, and that has the right SU2 cross U1 quantum numbers, and then multiplied by e to the I phi, and you can get something with the right, you might get something with the right scaling dimension. So we haven't played that game, but everything I say will rest on that game being played successfully. Okay, so I want to say something else about, so this was all free field theory, right? The calculations here are really, in some sense, extremely trivial. I just take free fields, add up the vacuum energy, add up their anomalies. There's something a little less trivial, which is to think about the graviton propagator. And I think people, for some reason, haven't appreciated this either. Let's just do the simplest thing. Couple gravity to the standard model and ask, how does it affect the graviton propagator? So here's the graviton propagator, just 1/k² with some tensor indices. This is how the standard loops of massless standard model particles change the graviton propagator. So you can have fermions, gauge bosons, circulating, or Higgs bosons, circulating in this loop. And there's an infinite series of these diagrams. And they were actually calculated in the 70s by Tombulis. He calculated fermions. John Donahue, who I think will be lecturing here next week, or maybe the week after, has also written many papers about it. And the result is very cute. Okay, so what's going on is the graviton, of course, couples to the stress energy. So the loop in these diagrams is nothing but the two-point function of the stress energy tensor. It's a conformal field theory. So you know exactly what that two-point function is in terms of one number. And that number is precisely the coefficient of Weyl squared, or it's related by a numerical factor to the coefficient of Weyl squared. So it's essentially a number that determines the loop diagram. The Fourier transform of 1/x⁸ is divergent. You've got to regularize and renormalize it. But in the end, it turns out to be k⁴, just like you'd expect. Integral d⁴x over x⁸ has dimensions of k⁴. And so you can calculate all these things analytically. This is the CT coefficient in terms of those same numbers I defined. And so you sum all these diagrams up, and you get the corrected graviton propagator. It's proportional to the projection operator onto spin 2. So it's this loop is automatically gauge invariant. And it has this funny denominator, right, which involves k² over m Planck². And this series is just expanding this function in powers of k² over m Planck². Now, this propagator looks pretty ugly. Okay, got a log that tells you there's a branch cut. If you analyze this, you will find two poles in the complex k² plane. That indicates a causality. And finally, at large k, it goes like 1/k⁴. And that's bad. That is inconsistent with Poincaré invariance and positivity of the Hilbert space. So it's really a bit of a disaster. Coupling the standard model to gravity is a bit of a disaster. Now, all of these papers sort of noticed some or all of those things, and essentially they made excuses for it. They said, oh, well, it's only an effective field theory. You know, we shouldn't expect causality on microscopic scales, et cetera, et cetera. However, string theory is an example of a theory which respects all these principles and only has poles in such propagators. And so, you know, we know of an example which is well-defined, and this is not well-defined in the same sense. So these corrections are problematic. They're inconsistent with the Callan-Lehmann representation, which you can prove. There's a very nice derivation in Peskin and Schroeder, for example, that any propagator in an interacting theory has to have this kind of representation, and you can more or less see from this formula, it can't fall faster than k². That's inconsistent with the positivity of this spectral density. And yet we've got k⁴. So we know something went wrong, and we were computing something gauge invariant. You see, If you compute a correlator of a non-gauge invariant thing, it doesn't have to satisfy this. But gauge invariant thing better satisfy this. False or a causal pulse. Now, what about dimension zero scalars? Well, of course, we use them to cancel this coefficient. So CT is negative for dimension zero scalars. So you plug that in here, this N effective is negative. And now it turns out this has a tachyon pole. The dimension zero scalars, coupled to gravity, create a tachyon. That's also bad. Okay. However, if you add the standard model and the dimension zero scalars, it all goes away. And all of these things cancel, and you're just left with the beautiful graviton propagator. Okay. So this is completely consistent. So the final topic I'm going to talk about is this one. It's the thing I'm most excited about. Using these assumptions, we're going to calculate from first principles the fluctuations in the CMB. So that's a new paper. Now, what we have to deal with is that our basic principle is we want the stress tensor to be traceless. Okay, why do we want that? Because we want the Big Bang to be a conformal singularity. Now, the standard model, the stress tensor is not traceless because of running couplings. The stress tensor trace is proportional to the beta functions in the theory, which obviously is a way of introducing a scale. The beta functions are scale dependent. They measure the scale dependence. And so it turns out the stress tensor trace is proportional to the beta function. This beta is finite temperature. So people have calculated this trace of standard model stress tensor at finite temperature. And so whereas for perfect radiation, pressure would be 1/3 rho and the trace would be zero, for standard model matter, there's a violation of that. So the pressure isn't quite 1/3 rho. There are terms involving the fine structure constant squared from each of the gauge groups with some numerical factors. And so P minus the third rho is a small number times temperature to the fourth. This anomalous trace can actually be canceled by introducing a coupling in the effective action for this phi field. So here we have the basic kinetic term for the phi field. One can couple phi to this Euler density and the Weyl density. And this action will then reproduce the trace anomaly due to this field. The way it does that is that actually this action is not Weyl invariant. Whereas this one is Weyl invariant, this term is not. And so even classically, there's a non-zero trace. Now you can do one better and cancel the trace anomaly due to running couplings by introducing a coupling like this. This is not an original trick. It's exactly the trick used in string theory in 2D, where people notice that if I put a string in a curved background, the 2D stress tensor is not traceless. And so they cancel that by introducing a term in the action for the string, which is the integral, 2D integral of dilaton times Ricci scalar. That's not Weyl invariant in 2D, and they adjust the coefficient to cancel the trace anomaly due to the string in a curved background, and that's how you get the string effective equations in a background with a non-trivial metric and a dilaton. So we just took the same mechanism in 2D and used it in 4D, and this corrects the Einstein fluid equation, and essentially because this has scale invariant fluctuations, now the Friedman equation becomes the following, where chi of x just depends on these fluctuating dimension zero fields. And so the expansion rate of the universe is now directly affected by these locally fluctuating dimension zero fields. And there are various constants in here. Everything is determined in terms of standard model parameters. So this conformal factor translates directly into the co-moving curvature perturbation. Cosmologists call this R, and we can get all the numbers this phi bar, sorry, this phi bar should actually be chi, and that's just a typo. So chi is the average of these 36 fields. Let's see how we get the spectral tilt. It's dominated by QCD, and QCD has asymptotic freedom. So that's telling you the fluctuations get, the alpha in QCD gets stronger at large distances. Okay, well, that's what we see in the sky. Okay, so the sign is correct. And then quantitatively, we have to go through a bit of a rigmarole to work out what is the trace anomaly, what's its microscopic origin. Essentially, it turns out there are two powers of k in the, which arise, two powers of alpha, which arise here. This trace anomaly has two powers of alpha. And it turns out one of those powers is due to the fact that at finite temperature, the field strength, the fields, so if I did QED, a free field, at finite temperature, F squared would be zero. It's E squared minus B squared at zeroth order. But when you have a non-zero coupling, F squared is not zero, it's proportional to alpha. So this, if you like, is a more sort of trivial source of alpha dependence. It's just the interactions of the gluons or non-abelian gauge bosons with themselves. The other factor in the, so F squared is one factor. The other factor is the running of the coupling, this beta. And we claim in our paper, we assume that this quantity, the other factor, depends on scale. So we'll go back to the Big Bang. We're going to run that from the Planck scale to 10 microns, 30 orders of magnitude in length scale. And we claim that this runs, this coefficient runs in accordance with the running of alpha with scale. Okay, so that's an assumption. I think it's the most reasonable assumption you can make. We make that assumption, and we end up with the scaling. And then it turns out that NS minus 1 is minus 7 alpha over pi, where alpha is the QCD coupling at the Planck scale. The critical exponent, which we can compute perturbatively, and then just extrapolate 30 orders of magnitude. Go back to this picture. So we're calculating it at the Planck length, at the Planck temperature, Planck time, and then just extrapolating 30 orders of magnitude in length scale to get the amplitude of what we see. Just to remind you, these are the couplings in the standard model. They run at the Planck scale, you know, to some finite numbers. They don't do anything weird. They're all perfectly finite at the Planck scale. So what we're actually using is this value at the Planck scale, which is has been determined by extrapolating from LHC. Here's the answer. So there are no other factors. I've showed you everything you need for this calculation. It took us several months to get all the numerical factors right. The answer was wrong for most of those several months. But when we converged on the correct answer, here it is, just powers of 2 and pi and things like that. The C beta is some function of standard model couplings, number of degrees of freedom. You may be used to 106.75 is the standard one. Well, we don't have the Higgs, okay? Because we're doing everything in this conformal theory at the Planck scale. So that's a small correction. We literally extrapolate from the Planck scale to K star, this 0.05 megaparsecs. Gives you a number 15. Put all this together, and here's our answer. The amplitude is about 10 to the minus 9, and the spectral index is 0.958. These are the measurements of Planck. Okay, and there's no cheating here. Okay, so, okay, you could say it's off by a factor of 2, but given this extrapolation of 30 orders of magnitude, given that we only calculated this to lowest order in alpha, given that we have no idea what the Higgs is, it's pretty remarkable. People ask me what the 7 is. The 7 is 11 minus 2/3 number of flavors, just the usual thing in beta function of QCD. So just to summarize, we are claiming that the Big Bang singularity is not, after all, that impossible to tackle. We perform an analytic extension through the Big Bang singularity, is a new picture of it as a CPT mirror. Calculated the gravitational entropy. We've got new explanations for all these things. I haven't talked about the dark matter. You can ask about that if you like. It's just a right-handed neutrino. It's absolutely not surprising that it exists. And then I've talked about dimension zero scalars. We didn't add any new propagating degrees of freedom to the standard model. These are very encouraging signs, but a lot remains to be done. Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Neil. If you have a question, just raise your hand. Pass this over.
Thank you very much for a really nice talk.
Thank you.
I have two questions. The first one is, you say that if you do this boundary condition calculation for the space-time metric, you get, if I didn't misunderstand you, you get a whole bunch of metrics that satisfy that boundary condition once you strip off the vowel factor. Did you choose a specific?
No. There's a unique solution. So let's go back to that. Okay, so when I fix the boundary three geometries and I ask what classical solution is consistent with that, turns out there's just one.
I see. Okay.
There's one in which the scale factor reverses. And you can sort of see that because A goes like T in a radiation dominated universe. So the assumption here is that this is Einstein gravity with radiation. Okay. And so there's a solution which looks like this for generic perturbed three geometry, providing I copy that three geometry here. Okay, so there's only one solution. If you impose the opposite boundary condition, that the scale factor is the same, then the only solution is trivial, that the four geometry is zero. And so.
I see, thank you. I had another question, which is, So at the singularity you had a conformal field theory, correct?
Yes.
And but at layered times, that conformal symmetry has to be broken.
Yes.
Because we have mass and structure.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So is there a dynamical mechanism that you propose for breaking the conformal symmetry, or?
Not yet.
How does that work?
Not yet. So you're absolutely right. When we assume the trace of the stress tensor is zero, we are putting in conformal symmetry. We are forced then to throw away the Higgs, okay? So we do not have a dynamical mechanism for generating, lepton masses, for example. And so that's something we have to fix. Now, the negative way of saying it is we've thrown the baby out with the bathwater, we don't have a Higgs field, and nothing works. The positive way of saying it is that we have a new approach to the hierarchy problem, which is that the Higgs is composite, and so some dynamics will be involved in seeing how that Higgs emerges, and that may well solve the hierarchy problem. So, but the simple statement is that it's to throw away mass or a mechanism of getting masses is a very non-trivial step. And that's what we've had to do in order to describe the Big Bang singularity. We've thrown away the Higgs mechanism and Higgs fields. So personally, I'm an optimist. So I think now we have this evidence from the CMB that there wasn't a fundamental Higgs. We have to try and explain how the fundamental Higgs emerged. But there are papers for example, there's a paper on how the Higgs is a bound state of neutrinos. This new right bar, new left has the quantum numbers of Higgs, and people have explored, and they claim that that's perfectly consistent with LHC data. Of course, there's a bunch of assumptions that they built into that, which I'm not sure I buy. But so you're right, this is a fundamental question, the origin of mass. And everything we've done doesn't address that at all.
Question?
I have a question. You talked about a scalar field theory, which doesn't have propagating degree of freedom in the mind.
Yes, yes.
We know cases in which, like topological field theories, where there are no propagating degree of freedom in the bulk, in the boundary, there are propagating degree of freedom.
Yes.
So what about your case?
Yes, good point. So, very good point. So in fact, this, I didn't dwell on this, but this dimension zero field also dates back to Dirac. Dirac wrote a paper called An Unusual Representation of the Conformal Group. The Dirac was also interested in conformal symmetry, and he discovered representations of the conformal group which have a lower state, but an infinite tower of states built on it. Okay? And people have been thinking about this for a while, and then people came up with dimension zero fields as a way of realizing that representation of the conformal group. And this was now called the Dirac singleton. And the way they realized it was by putting it into ADS, and then they found this dimension zero field is confined to the boundary of ADS. Okay? And so this was 10 years before ADS-CFT, and it's recognized as a forerunner of ADS-CFT. Now, I've been discussing with sort of experts in this kind of thing. The conjecture, it's only a conjecture, is that dealing with dimension zero fields in Minkowski space may be like doing ADS-CFT without a boundary, whatever that means. You see, the ADS bulk, why is it there? It's there because you want to represent the conformal group of the boundary, right? So the conformal group of the boundary is represented as the space-time symmetry of the bulk. But if what's really fundamental is the conformal symmetry, maybe you don't need the bulk, okay? And this is interesting possibility. So I don't have a good answer, but there's something very interesting going on with these Dirac singleton or dimension zero fields, or whatever. They have no propagating degrees of freedom, but they have all sorts of nice properties.
Thanks, Niamh, for the very nice talk. So I would have many questions. Let me ask just two. One is related to the mechanism that would provide conformal invariance. And so you said that at the moment you are just inputting there by hand.
We're insisting on it.
You are insisting on that.
Yeah.
And you say that the crucial point is you don't have there the conformal invariance there because of the running of couplings. But in principle...
Well, we cancel the violation with a linear term.
But in principle, although the couplings run, it is possible that they approach an asymptotically safe regime. So
yes,
it can be asymptotically free or asymptotically safe, but this would provide a dynamical mechanism to achieve at least the scale invariance.
Yes, yes.
And related to that, so I wanted to ask how crucial is specifically conformal invariance versus scale invariance in what you are doing?
No, we do need a traceless stress tensor.
Okay. Caveat.
So if you deal with matter and Einstein gravity,
yes,
and you want the singularity to be purely conformal, then you need a traceless stress tensor. Now, it's possible that gravity itself gets modified. For example, it might become vial gravity, in which case it would be vial. The whole thing would be vial invariant. But our approach is sort of minimal throughout. So we're assuming Einstein gravity coupled to matter, and then trying to cure this non-tracelessness of the stress tensor. And we find that
at least the matter part. But then in the gravitational part, so for instance, we have shown the graviton propagator by Donoghue that already assumes that there are higher derivatives. And actually, higher derivatives might also contribute to maximize the gravitational entropy. So I think this is something that has also been proposed recently, not recently, 2 years ago by Kelly Stell.
Right.
That once you allow for higher derivatives, automatically the configurations that are most probable are those that are homogeneous and isotropic. And this might also be related to...
Yeah, so my problem with high derivative gravity is it violates Poincaré invariance and positivity. So that sounds pretty bad to me.
Depends on the derivatives you have. And depends on how many derivatives you have, because they could sum up and...
They could sum up, yeah. This is a very naive summation. It's true.
And related to that, probably I have a comment. So you saw Donoghue's propagator. Yes, it is true that... it has a ghost, but it is an unstable one, and also it is a one-loop approximation, so it doesn't necessarily extend to very high energies, so that might be...
Yeah, as I said, this is kind of making excuses. you can look at these propagators with the wrong properties and say, oh, well, it doesn't really matter. The wrong properties don't really matter if it's slightly acausal. But, you know, I want to take the opposite point of view. I want to say that these are clues as to, you know, this needs to be fixed. If you always just make excuses for things, you probably don't end up with any predictions. I want to be the optimist and say that these problems are actually clues and we need to remove these problems. String theory was built by insisting on these good properties of the S-matrix. And you ended up with this, it may be the wrong theory, but it's super consistent. Perturbation theory is super consistent. So I want to follow the same route, but without all the extra baggage of extra dimensions and supersymmetry and all that stuff. So I want to take the minimal possible route to the same good behavior. That's the intention.
Okay, maybe in view of the time, I should note that I think there's supposed to be tea and snacks in the bistro afterwards, so we can continue the discussion there. But let's thank Neil again for this nice talk.